to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me on the East Coast is Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
Yeah, Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's been a very busy week in the news that we follow, and just, you know, putting together the podcast, it's been pretty interesting. It's just looking at some of the things that are going on. You know, a lot of it is a build up to this Facebook IPO that's, I guess, now going to happen middle of this month.
Yeah, I think the 18th or 19th or something like that.
Yeah, they were saying that because they're doing their roadshow next week, that they expect the IPO will happen on the 18th. So I'm sure everyone will be looking at that as a barometer for, you know, social media and tech IPOs and everything else. So that seems like it'll be a big deal when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what new to be said, what new remains to be said in the stories that are going to be there about the IPO. But if it tanks after a while, oh my God, the market will just completely tank. If Facebook tanks after a while, it will.
Why do you think it would tank? Just because of what they spent so much on Instagram, their everything, but their growth isn't quite growing as much as they said. I mean, it seems like everything's pointing to it being a really big IPO.
Yeah, no, the IPO will be big, but if the stock tanks after the IPO happens and in the next few days, like it happened with Demand and some of the other companies that you and I follow,
right?
Then it will just, I don't know if it'll happen, but I'm saying if it happens, it's going to have a huge ripple effect on anybody else in the tech industry.
No doubt.
And our guest that's going to come on will probably have a lot more to say about that, actually.
That's true. Eric Jackson is an investor. He'll definitely, we'll be talking a little bit more about Facebook with him too. Also, there was this news that Hulu is considering doing authentication for people watching Hulu shows for free, that they would basically authenticate whether they have to have a cable or satellite subscription in order to use Hulu, which kind of is the whole point of Hulu, is that, you know, for us cord cutters, you know, that's we watch it because we don't have cable. So that seems like that would be a completely different business model that's already has people up in arms upset about that.
Yeah, I saw the story. It was just that one New York Post story, right? There was nothing else beyond that.
Yeah, a few other people kind of confirmed it, but I think what they were saying is that it's not going to happen for a few years, is the way they were trying to say, that it's just under development and that it might take a while for them to actually implement it. But the fact that they're even doing it.
TV everywhere. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be big. They're TV everywhere. When it came out, it was said, it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that Hulu will be the authentication engine for TV everywhere. So it seems... which at that point seemed more conceptual. I think this may be how it's going to play out.
And that's because TV Everywhere never really did a good job of authenticating everything.
Yeah, I mean, their TV Everywhere sort of didn't go anywhere, really, but in the sense that the individual companies have their own efforts, Time Warner Cable being the forefront of it. HBO, of course, being part of Time Warner, has done that quite a bit. But TV Everywhere, I guess, was never supposed to be a consumer brand of sorts, but it was more for individual companies to do their things. Hulu, I guess, because it's owned by four of the media companies, would be a front end to that authentication process. It's going to be I guess, for people like you and me who don't have TV, we'll have to pay for Hulu Plus, right? Is that what they're saying?
Well, that's what's not clear, and that's what some of you are actually asking. You know, is this just about free Hulu, or is it about even paying for it? Like, even if you pay for Hulu Plus, are you still going to have to authenticate, or does that basically get you out of having cable? And I don't think that's really clear at this point.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting, where if somebody who has a cable subscriber already wants Hulu Plus, will they get it for free? And then us who are not, don't have cable, we'll have to pay. So it's kind of, yeah, this will be interesting to see how it shakes out. And, I mean, it's not going to do any good to the Hulu brand anytime soon.
No, definitely not. And then the last thing that came up is this whole thing around Byliner, who we had spoken to before. They do these kind of singles, or just kind of shorter books or e-books that aren't quite book length, they've had some success. They had a byliner original from Buzz Bissinger, who had done Friday Night Lights. It was called After Friday Night Lights, kind of an update on the book. And Apple had run a special kind of a cut rate deal on that, and Amazon lowered it down to the price down to zero, and basically were giving away for free. And Byliner ended up having to pull it off of Amazon because they didn't want it to be priced at zero. And this kind of caused a whole ruckus with Buzz Bissinger kind of being caught in the middle and feeling a little bit burned because obviously he had something that was successful and doing really well, and then having to have it pulled from Amazon and Kindle. And I tried to get Byliner to come on our podcast to talk about it, and they basically kind of gave us the no comment. We're not talking about this right now.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some legal stuff involved too. I wonder, I haven't followed it very closely, but I wonder like if FTC would get involved at some point for like anti-competitive reasons, Amazon trying to completely destroy the market kind of thing.
By it's kind of like giving the browser away type thing. Like, we're just going to make it zero to the point where we're going to lose money on this because it's going to help us kind of hurt our competition. Well, there is the FTC investigation into Apple and the book publishers kind of colluding to get prices higher. But because of that, everyone's kind of wondering, well, but how is Amazon getting off on this? Like, why is the focus on? I mean, there's an obvious, if there is collusion, there's obviously a reason to look at what Apple was doing and these other publishers, some of whom have already kind of settled this. But a lot of people are also saying, well, what about Amazon? They're the real, the real possible, one that's kind of throwing its power around in the in this space. And we have a story today on MediaShift about kind of self-published authors using this kind of Amazon Kindle publishing service, and not wanting to use it just because they ask for an exclusive and they take a certain amount out of the price. And it's, I guess this is the issue that comes up a lot for publishers and for authors is, Amazon's such a big player, you kind of have to go by their rules in a way, and so sometimes they stretch those rules and go a little too far.
Yeah, I mean this is going to be the story of the next few years that's going to play out. Like, remember how the music industry issues got played out in the early 2000s? This is going to be for the next decade.
No question. And Amazon in particular is going to be kind of in the crosshairs of a lot of people, and it'll be interesting to see how they react to all that. So we'll definitely come back to that. But for this episode, we'll talk about Rafat had done a special Q&A with Dan Rather about his upcoming memoir and just his thoughts on the future of journalism, the present of journalism, and where we are with that. And then we'll talk to Eric Jackson about his recent story where he wrote about Google and Facebook possibly going away within 5 years. We'll talk about that scenario. And then we'll talk to the founder and CEO of a new service called Snippet, which is a social curation service, kind of like Pinterest, except for stories and news. So we'll talk to him as well. First, we'll turn to an icon in the journalism world, Dan Rather, a former CBS News investigative reporter, anchorman, and currently has his own show on HDNet called Dan Rather Reports. He recently put out a new memoir called Rather Outspoken, and our Rafat Ali was able to do a Q&A with Dan Rather while he was on a train going to DC. Here are some excerpts from that interview.
Your views of the state of journalism as you've outlined in the book, and how to see the future of it. At some point in the book, you've said American journalism is in crisis. The corporatization, politicization, and the trivialization of news. But you also say you see some signs of it getting somewhat better. And I'm just wondering if you want to start with some of the positive signs of how you see it getting better, and of course, what you're doing with HDNet as well.
That I am an optimist by experience and by nature. And while I do think that American journalism has been and remains in many important ways in crisis, that I'm fairly optimistic about the future. That in springing off of that, that the internet and entering the internet age has opened all kinds of new vistas of possibilities. That, in my opinion, the internet is already the major source of most news for most people. That's not to say that I think it will eliminate television, radio, or print. It'll be supplemental in the same way when radio came on, everybody predicted, well, nobody's going to read newspapers. Well, people didn't stop reading newspapers and magazines. Radio supplemented it and expanded people's opportunities for information and news. You know, I'm encouraged about what the potential is for the future. However, and I don't want to belabor the point, but we're in a period of what I call an interregnum. It's a word from the Roman Catholic Church. I'm not Catholic, but Catholics sometimes speak of an interregnum. The interregnum is when the old order is dead or dying, but the new order has not gotten fully in place, there is an interregnum. And right. So I think we're in an interregnum period, which has its perils, is a dangerous period for us. I think in journalism we're still in an interregnum. That is that the old order is at least dying and in some ways dead, becoming dinosaur-like. But the right. new order is not yet fully in place. That the internet, well, we're not any longer in the first stages of the internet. It hasn't fully developed itself, and it has applied to journalism, for example. With very few exceptions, nobody has quite figured out a new business model for quality journalism with integrity. There are some places, in fact, quite a few places, I think, where you can find quality journalism of integrity on the web. But to finance really top quality international coverage, for example, nobody has yet figured out a business model that will support that with deep digging investigative reporting, which is expensive. It's resource intensive. Again, with very few exceptions, nobody has figured out a way, nobody has come up with a business model to finance really good investigative reporting on a sustained basis. I think that somebody will begin to come up with business models, but again, with few exceptions, up to and including now, that has not happened. So when I say American journalism is in crisis, it's rooted in this belief that we're in this interregnum period.
Right. Now, and in this in-between period that the media is going through, do you think there is a danger that people, specifically American people, who are increasingly getting turned off by what they see in news on TV and other sources, meanwhile the news sources that need to develop haven't, and the American civic society sort of gets turned off media for a long time to come? Do you think there's a danger of that happening, or is it already happening?
I think it's beginning to happen. That among the many reasons that I think people are puzzled about what's happening with news reporting is that in my lifetime, entertainment values have virtually overwhelmed news values. An example would be many of the television programs that are presented and advertised as, quote, news programs are much more entertainment oriented. An example would be if something big happens on the international scene, the increasing instinct has been to put four people in the room to shout their opinions at one another. You know, ideally what you'd have are reporters on the ground. Let's take what's happening in Africa below the Sahara. Sudan would be a prime example, or the increased emphasis by China dominating the South China Sea. Entertainment values have overwhelmed the news values. When I talk about the trivialization of the news, which you mentioned earlier, it's in that context. And so people, they flip around the television dial, or for that matter, look at Twitter or Facebook or any number of places on the web. And yes, you can still find quality news of integrity, but it's in very short supply. In many important ways, American journalists and journalistic enterprises have lost their spine. I do not accept myself from this criticism that, asking tough questions, asking very tough follow-up questions has gone badly out of style.
So I was speaking of, since international news is very near and dear to your heart and something that I'm very, that I've sort of dedicating my life to as well, are you heartened by the rise of sources like Al Jazeera English? I wonder if you've seen it or you watch it, but it did a really good job covering the Arab Spring. And, of course, the aftermath of what's happening there, other sources like Guardian from UK coming into America, trying to show an alternative way or alternative viewpoint about international issues. Do you think net all of these will have a good effect on what's happening in coverage of international media?
I certainly hope so, and I see some signs that that's happening. About Al Jazeera, yes, I have seen them. Of course, I've seen them overseas since I travel overseas quite a bit. But I've also seen Al Jazeera in our own country. And while I do not agree with everything Al Jazeera does or how they do it, and I have my own concerns about them, I do think that overall, in the main, that they are a plus. They often give a different perspective. They often are covering live on the ground in places where other people aren't. You mentioned the coverage of the Arab Spring, particularly with the situation in Egypt last year. In my personal opinion, they were at the very least among the best covering it, and in many ways they were the best. Their coverage was the best because they had a lot of people on the ground, and the people on the ground were all, most of them were Arab speakers. So, I applaud the BBC coming into the U.S. market and bringing a somewhat different perspective, adding the coverage, and also without Al Jazeera. And I say that recognizing that Al Jazeera has become controversial, and there are people who want to keep them off of cable channels in their region or area. But I see this, both of these specific examples of BBC and Al Jazeera, as pluses.
I think that would be it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Arlo. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, now let's turn to Eric Jackson and his story about the future of Google and Facebook. Eric Jackson is founder and managing member of Iron Fire Capital. He completed his PhD in management department at Columbia University in New York with a specialization in strategic management. He's been an outspoken activist shareholder and critic of Yahoo and contributes to Forbes.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So you wrote a really interesting piece that's getting a lot of buzz and a lot of readership in Forbes, talking about why it's possible that Google and Facebook could disappear in the next 5 to 8 years. And part of what you wrote is that management is not always ready to deal with the kind of the mobile era of the internet. Just as Web 1.0 companies couldn't deal with the switch to Web 2.0, the Web 2.0 companies won't survive this switch to mobile. Does that kind of sum up what you were saying? And you also talked about, you put this into the frame of organizational sociology.
Right.
So maybe first explain what organizational sociology is and how that kind of relates to the future of these companies.
Well, when I went back to, or when I was back in grad school, I was studying strategic management, and and I always had a bias, and my professors always had a bias that, with great leadership and a great strategy, basically a company can overcome anything. And at the time, there was a school of thought, which I, was kind of diametrically opposed to that view, which came from these organizational sociologists. A lot of them came from Berkeley, actually. And they had the view that, leadership is just a bunch of rah-rah stuff that we it's sort of the equivalent of lottery winners. And then we go around writing articles about these people that were CEOs of these companies that just sort of, through happenstance, actually came out the winners, but that they weren't really the primary forces behind an organization's success. And so these sociologists studied other forces, such as, when companies were born, the degree of competition that surrounded them at the time that they were born, how long, their generation will last, and just how difficult it is once you start a company and you're successful, that's difficult in and of itself, just sort of getting past the first couple of years. But then how companies struggle once the environment changes and suddenly, what they had learned to do so well to be a successful company in one context, has suddenly morphed, and they're just not able to adapt and change and adjust as well to this new context. And that's when they get sideswiped by these up-and-coming companies who don't have any history, don't have any kind of, cultural baggage or anything.
I mean, do you think, is there something in particular about the web or just kind of internet companies that things are happening even at a faster pace than, let's say, companies that happened in the 70s or the 50s or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, back 15 years ago, when these ecologists were talking about this academically, I mean, they were referring to the steel industry, or maybe if they were really up with it, they were talking about, mini computers, things like, and that was considered, very kind of fast moving industry in comparison to the steel industry. And the fact is that just the pace of change, in the world of internet companies, I just think is that much faster. And there's just, even compared to software, I think there's just a lot, there's not the same, you don't have the same opportunity. Like, think of a company like Microsoft, where you've got this huge installed base of people running, Microsoft, Windows 7, and when they can go to Windows 8, and they know that there's going to be, a huge majority of those enterprise customers that are going to update. In the world of the web, you're only as good as, the people who kind of show up tomorrow and decide to log into your site. So I think the pace of change is just making it more and more difficult over time. And I think it's just going to increase over the next 5 years for even the successful companies today to adapt.
Eric, this is Rafat. So specifically bringing it to Google and Facebook, mm-hmm. You can see even now to some extent what Google is going through and how what you're saying will eventually play out. Can you explain that? And then secondly, on Facebook, which for a lot of people has become the internet, mm-hmm. In a lot of countries in the world, where do you see their weakest? You're saying mobile is their weakest point, but that is the biggest mobile app by far, and compared to any other app in the mobile ecosystem.
Right.
Despite the fact that there aren't that great in the mobile web.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things when you look at Google is that unlimited capital and unlimited brains really do not solve this problem. Because, you know, on the surface, Google's got whatever it's now, $40 billion in the bank. They've got, you know, dozens of Rhodes Scholars that work at this company. You know, and yet, you know, they have continued to struggle in areas like, you know, deals, Google Wallet. You know, you pick a, you know, now Google Plus. You know, on the surface, it would seem that they should be smart enough and have enough money to throw at this problem of kind of getting into these areas. And yet, you know, they continue to stumble. And so I think with them, you know, I think the big issue they're having is that, you know, the vast majority, and we don't know exactly what it is today because they don't break this out, but we know the vast majority of their revenues and even more so their profits come from desktop search. And now as we're moving into the mobile, people are still searching, yes, but their behavior in the mobile environment is very different from the desktop environment. And so it's very, and so potentially they're going to search a lot less than they did in the desktop world. And so it's not that that's going to kill them and put them out of business, you know, but they will disappear and, you know, sort of in prominence in comparison to what they are today, just in the same way that Yahoo today is just very different, even though it gets 700 million visitors every month. You know, it doesn't have the same degree of prominence as it did 10 years ago or 12 years ago.
It's almost like a parallel to what's going on in the news business and kind of traditional media, because they're the same way. They're so used to a legacy way of doing things that it's very hard for them to kind of switch midstream and start putting all their effort into the internet.
Right. And so I guess, you know, when you look back on history, I mean, you think that, you know, Facebook didn't become Facebook by being a better Yahoo. They became Facebook by doing something that was completely new and different. And nobody knew beforehand that, you know, that such they would want such a service until they saw it and until their friends got on it and so forth. So, you know, to get to the Yahoo, to sort of the Facebook angle, you know, and this ties in with the newspaper industry too. I mean, I don't think Facebook's going to be taken down by a better Facebook. It's going to be some sort of new app that doesn't exist today, but it just becomes very compelling and very interesting. And it's probably very different from what Facebook does. And Facebook might see that. Maybe they'll try to buy it in the early days, like they just did with Instagram, to get that magic pixie dust. Or maybe they'll try to compete with it, as Google has done with Google Plus. But it's, again, I think they will fall into sort of the same trap of when they've grown up organizationally to sort of think a certain way, and they've developed this hacker way culture of building websites. It's become, and then all of a sudden it's morphed into, we're now in a mobile context. You know, I think it will just be, they'll be slower to adapt, slower to change, slower to recognize the change that's occurring.
So the Facebook IPO, which I'm sure you're watching too, is going to happen next week, if the reports are right. 6 months down the line, what are we going to be saying about the Facebook stock?
Well, I think I suspect it's going to be this immediate pop, because this is going to be the biggest tech IPO since for the last 8 years, right? Yeah. Since Google. So I think there's going to be a tendency to kind of sort of everybody rushing through the door at the same time at the beginning, and could force it up. And I think it could see something like $140 billion initially. And even 6 months out, you know, it's possible, you know, they could still have a very frothy valuation. But I think, you know, it's going to be sort of a year from now and 18 months from now, I think, where the true test is going to come of them. And I think, you know, this could be another issue for them in adapting to this mobile world, is that they have very little revenue today in comparison to what their market capitalization is going to be. And whether they say this or not, that creates enormous pressure on a management team and on Zuckerberg to suddenly get the revenue up. And so their focus could shift to how do we monetize now, as opposed to, you know, how do we really develop some kind of new experience, new mobile experience? Maybe that's completely different from what we've done to be successful to this point.
No question. Well, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate all your insight.
Okay, guys. It's been fun.
So now we'll turn to Snippet and the rise of social curation services. Launched last year, Snippet was a way to clip stories, videos, and images you like online and create collections based on topics. It's similar to Pinterest, but using articles instead of just images. They even recently had a contest to see who could create the best Snippet collection related to the environment for Earth Day. So Rami Adib is the founder and CEO of Snippet. He's originally from Egypt, where by the age of 13, he had developed a database solution to manage employee records of a large organization. Prior to founding Snippet, he worked as a principal at Kozla Ventures, where he worked on a number of investments, including Square, GroupMe, which was acquired by Skype, and Nest Technologies. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So you founded, or at least, you know, kind of launched Snippet kind of late last year. Tell us first kind of your motivation for starting the site. What kind of got you interested in doing it, and what your kind of your mission and goals were with it?
So back in March of 2011, as you pointed out, I was a principal at Kozla Ventures, and we had a small revolution back home in Egypt. And all my friends reached out to me, and they said, Rami, what's happening in Egypt? And I started sharing with them the best content I could find, the best articles, the best videos I could get on the Arab Spring. And I started sharing that on Twitter and Facebook, and I immediately realized two big challenges. The first challenge I came across is that all of my followers on Twitter were folks interested in entrepreneurship and venture capital. So when I started saying Arab Spring, that wasn't exactly what they were there for. But a second and bigger challenge is that every link I would share on Twitter, within 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 2 hours, it would totally disappear. And the same was Facebook. In fact, a study that was just published by Bitly pointed out a half-life of, I think, 4 minutes for any link shared on Twitter. And what became very obvious to me is that these social media tools are amazing at disseminating information and headlines. But what was lacking is a place for me to save, store, and share the most seminal articles and content in any topic I care about. And so I quit my job and started Snippet as a place to collect the favorite articles in an issue and to dive deeper into that issue over time.
How do you see it relating to kind of previous aggregation or kind of curation services like Delicious and things like that? It seems like kind of a visual version of that in a way.
So the there are probably two key differences. One difference is Snippet is really about the best articles or the best content, not just any bookmark. And from that perspective, there is a strong element. You know, not every article on entrepreneurship, for example, was published in the past 5 minutes. The best articles of entrepreneurship was maybe published 5 hours or 5 days ago. They were probably published 5 years ago. And we think of Snippet as a place where the best content lives. Also, Snippet is a place where it's not just about the link. It's about your thoughts on that link. And it's a place, in essence, for self-expression, where people don't just share an article, but share their views on that topic backed by their favorite content. And in essence, it becomes a platform for self-expression based on interest.
Have you guys worried run into any kind of copyright issues? I know that's come up on Pinterest, which is kind of a similar visual sharing service. Is that something that you've kind of run into?
Well, not at all, because whereas Pinterest is about images, and they copy the image onto their site, and then when you click on an image on Pinterest, they show you a copy of the full-sized image that you just clicked on Snippet. We're about articles. And so the moment you click on any article on Snippet, we immediately take you to that publisher's website to read that article. So publishers actually love us because we drive straight traffic to them and we never copy their content onto our site.
How much do you see, Ramiz Rafat, how much do you see the Snippet service becoming a destination in itself versus an enabler, as you use the word, platform that sort of resides in different places as opposed to expecting people to come here?
So the what we have seen since we've launched is it is becoming a big destination for our user base. So we've seen our users spend 3, 4, 5 hours on the site discovering content. They use a site, they find great content, they read that content, and then they come back in the site to find more similar content curated by the same people. It's not easy to build a site that encourages people to leave the site and then bring them back on again. But that's part of our mission, and I think we have done a lot of things in the UI to encourage that behavior.
And what do you guys look at as kind of your business model? Do you think there'll be kind of sponsored snips or kind of suggested things, or how is that going to work? Because that's one thing a lot of people have wondered about with Pinterest too, is, you know, where does the revenue going to come from?
In a funny way, this brings me back to 1999. Where the big question was, will search engines ever be able to monetize? And I think what Google has proven is that if you are a site that drives links to other sites, and if you have high quality content and high user engagement and traffic, it really is easy to monetize. So all of the approaches you've pointed out could work. We haven't been focused on monetization to date. We've been focused first and foremost in building the best product. And as part of that, as we think about monetization, the key is to make it very obvious for the end user what is sponsored and what is not. Whether we put it on the right-hand side, you put it as a sponsored tweet, you put it as a Google ad in yellow on the top or on the right or both, what matters is telling your user, this is content surfaced by the best of the community and this is sponsored content, and you can then monetize while maintaining the trust you have with your user base.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure, and it was a pleasure being on the show.
Here are some excerpts from that interview. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, Dan Rather, Eric Jackson, and Rami Adib. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/idealab. And our new...